Hi everyone, this is Sam McNary, Deputy Editor and Head of Content at EG and co-chair of EG's Rewire, a club that I created for women across the industry to get together, to learn and to take away a few nuggets from our sessions. Last week, we at Rewire became rock stars, or at least we started to thrash our heads about a bit and do that weird thing with your hand, or something like that. Or really nothing like that. What we did was learn some lessons from a panel of really powerful, insightful, and generally kick-ass women who shared their often comical, and you'll have to excuse the guffawing from me and the audience in this podcast, sometimes self-deprecating, but always inspiring tales of how they became their own rock stars. First up, let's hear from Roz Good, Senior Director, our host for the evening, GVA.
Well, I'm probably the most boring story, actually, because I started at JR Eve in 1986, and I've been at the same place ever since, which is, in today's terms, is terribly, terribly sad. But in terms of why I've got to where I am now and how I've got to where I am now, I would absolutely say absolutely not by design. It's been a journey that has been, as far as I'm concerned, has not had a game plan to it, other than being outgoing, clearly ambitious but not probably knowing it, and having a go, and the descriptions that you've been given around that, being prepared to be knocked back and get up and dust down and get on with it, has probably defined why I have been able to navigate through the way that I have, because I've never considered myself bright, because I really am not bright, but I get people, and I love working with people, and I think this the process that I've been through, and actually probably the reason that I've stayed in terms of being a woman in a senior position and having a family in the process, has been because I've been in an environment where I have been in a route to achieve that and have been supported to achieve that. So at the point in time when I started a family, I had, there was no real internet access. It was that VPN, the visible panty line VPN thing that we all had to do, for those that are old enough, of everything sort of being plugged in and never terribly working terribly well. But it was the enablement of what we now talk about as remote working. And I started a family at the point in time that the remote working started to be accessible to us in career terms. And I had a forward-thinking series of line managers who basically said, "We know you can do what you do really, really well, just do it wherever you want to do it." So I was enabled from a very early stage. And I think that's been the reason I've stayed, because I've been supported, and the reason I've been successful is because they've run out of reasons not to let me do this job.
Next is Linda Schiller. She's Chief Executive of Manchester Airports Group.
So I have been Chief Executive of Manchester Airport Group, or MAG, as some of you will know, and their property business for 3 years. It's probably my fourth really big executive job. I think, you know, so when I look back over my career as to how I've ended up here, I mean, most days I really don't know. But actually what I can tell you is that as a teenager, I actually have jumped off one of those boards in that pool in Sheffield, I grew up about 5 miles away. I was absolutely wild, and I never took no for an answer. I never did what I was told. I was actually quite studious, which actually did help, because I did have to pass some exams at some point in my life. I was the first person in my entire family to go to university. I went into work not really knowing what I was going to do, but actually having done a degree in finance, decided I'd carry on being an accountant. Started life in the public sector, got bored with that really quickly because it just didn't move fast enough and there were too many rules and regulations. And I did have a boss in one job who actually fell asleep every lunchtime at his desk and you could go in the office and walk around him. Then went to work for BT, which was just an amazing company. It was an amazing company to be technology, fast moving, restructured every 18 months, masses of opportunity. Probably met some brilliant, I would say, sponsors as well as mentors actually in that business, who just kept chucking stuff at me because I was like that Duracell bunny, it hit me and I'd got up and I kept going. And I did all the really shitty jobs basically that none of the guys would really touch. They were really hard. And was often out there right on a limb with a load of people in the room just waiting for me to fall flat on my face. Survived numerous bosses who had been sponsors and mentors leaving the company, but just kept going, became property director of BT. And then I left BT because I was sort of really run out of where I was going to go in that company, and I was told 5 years and three different jobs and you'll end up on a board. And I was thinking, oh God, you know, give me a break. So at the time, the co-op approached me about a job, and I went in to be the MD of Cooperative Estates, sat on their exco, ran probably one of the biggest property businesses in the country. BT had also been one of the biggest property businesses in the country. Did that for 4 years, did some amazing things, which we're going to talk about later. Then got approached 4 years in because, again, I was looking for that next. I wanted to go on to a mainline business board. Every business I'd been in property wasn't a mainline business. And the chief exec said, just wait a year, I just need a year to sort something out. And I was approached by Lloyds Bank, actually, to come and run their real estate lending business after the crash. I wasn't a banker, they didn't want a banker, they wanted somebody who understood the industry. And I went and did that, and I think that was probably one of the hardest jobs I've ever done. Arrogant professional stretch, it's the only time in my life I think I've been arrogant and thought, like, why can't I do this? It's only banking. It was really hard. Technically not that difficult, but politicians hated us, the press hated us, the public hated us, and we were supposed to be on the other side when I went into it. So that was really sort of difficult, but took me into real estate fund management. So I went into SWIP, which was owned by Lloyds, and ran the fifth biggest real estate fund management business in the UK. And then when we were bought by Aberdeen, for the first time in my life, I found myself with an organisation that didn't really want me and that I didn't really want to go and work in, because they didn't have the right job. So said, right, I'm going to have a year off, and ended up working at MAG. So I had a really interesting route to here. All of it has been quite accidental in some ways. I did have three kids along the way as well, so I don't know sort of what they feel about it. You might have asked those, but that's me.
And here's Lloyds' newly installed head of commercial real estate, who, now that I think about it, I probably rather rudely asked if she was an arrogant banker.
I try not to be, but my mum has, over the years, told me I have just a smidge of arrogance. I call it belief, but the thin line. So I obviously work in banking. I work at Lloyds. I head up the commercial real estate team there. I look after 60 people that are based around the UK. We lend £8.6 billion into the industry each year across a range of different sectors and a range of different client sets. And how did I end up here? It sounds very similar to your stories, really, which is I left university having done geophysics. So obviously everyone goes, oh, right, well, what do you do with that? And I didn't know when I left, and I still don't know what you're supposed to do with that. Well, I wanted to be an astronaut. So I investigated whether I could be an astronaut. And they said, good, can you see? I was like, no. Like, what do you mean you can't? Well, I wear contact lenses. So you can't be an astronaut that wears contact lenses. And the laser vision correction hadn't really kicked off by then. So mum said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'll take a year off. And I'm blatantly going to have that sort of moment, eureka moment. I'm travelling around the world where I'll suddenly know what I'm going to do. So of course I didn't. I came back and mum was like, you cannot live at home. Go and just get any job. So she got me a job at the golf course, to which I worked about a week. I was like, this is horrendous. I can't do this. So she packed me down to London, and I ended up getting a job at a property company called Land Securities, which obviously I'm sure most of you know, in investment strategy. So I worked there for about a year. That was probably the hardest year I've had in my career, because I knew absolutely nothing about property. And I thought, having done geophysics, that working at a sort of, Excel, all the modelling tools that I had to have would be really easy. And I was just like, oh my God, it's impossible. But I learned so much in that year. And within a year, I was working on a deal, and the bank who was funding us said, well, actually, you work pretty hard. I was working all-nighters, which I wouldn't recommend. It's not ideal, and I think we've moved away from that, which is a good place to be. But why don't you come over and work for the bank? So I said, fine, yeah, okay, this can't be that difficult, but like banking will be fine. And actually, I started, and it was, the 2000s, and it was the best time to be a banker, because valuations were just going up. You could lend any money you wanted to the yen curve. It was never going to end. It was all going to be fine. The story from there. So, as Linda points out, working in banking from about 2008 to even recently is an incredibly difficult and stressful place to be. It is getting a little bit easier. And, you know, one of those things has been massively to try and change the culture within these organisations. And that's where a mentor, like being a mentor and being a mentee, has been most important, because it's not just about what you're supposed to do, it's all about sort of conduct and culture and how you get that right in the organisation. We've had a massive shift in terms of that. It does help that obviously we're increasing the number of women in the banks. I think that does make a big impact. So I've been working in banking for a long time. I ended up coming to Lloyds in 2014. I was actually on my second maternity leave, and I got a call from Lloyds saying, do you want to come and work for us? And I said, absolutely no way, thank you very much. I said, well, why don't you just come for a coffee? I was like, okay. But like you said, just listen, you know, you don't have to go in and say, well, what are you all about? Just have a listen. So I went over, 9 interviews later. they asked for another interview, and I said, no, you either want me or you don't. So they decided to take me on. I stayed there for a year before I took my next maternity leave. But I said to them, don't worry, I'm much more productive when I come back from maternity leave. I tend to work in 10-month cycles.
How much into your current cycle are you?
So my latest kid is 15 months old. So I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 15-month-old.
How's your productivity?
Incredible. But that is also due to the support I have, the networks I have, both at work and at home, and I couldn't do it without those networks.
So our next panellist is a woman who is joining us directly from Paris and who would ordinarily be described as fearless. Ordinarily. Not on this night. As on the way to her panel, she was WhatsApping me saying she might be just a little bit late as there was a spider in her car. You'll find out more about that later. But here's entrepreneur Emma Sinclair.
I discovered two things about you today. One, that you have a Wikipedia page on you. And two,
I discovered that on Friday, is it? The first time in my life.
And it says that your first job was in McDonald's.
It was. And being very competitive, ambitious, and focused from an early age, I'd like to report that I got 5 stars. So, I mean, everyone has a different story. Mine's probably quite different. I'd say probably the grounding for my ambition was the property industry, but that was through my father. I would cite my ambition and my drive kind of starting from about the age of 4. My dad took me to school my whole life and was in real estate. So I grew up through the kind of 80s and 90s, the first real estate companies floating. And I used to read my dad, crazy as it sounds, after we did Times Table and how many yellow cars can you spot, we used to do the what's the share price of. And my dad didn't have very much money, but my dad had a couple of £100 in utilities that had just floated, and 1 or 2 other stocks. So every morning from a very early age, I read my dad a few share prices from the FT, and that was just kind of normal. And then as I got older, I would read the back page of the FT, which is the next column in for anyone else that reads that. Started to talk about what price earnings ratios were and market caps, which is also in the columns if anyone reads the share prices. And when I got to university at 18, I'd been working in McDonald's for a couple of years, had a sort of allowance, but I wasn't really, couldn't afford to buy shoes. I just don't have the same habit incidentally, but I couldn't afford to buy any shoes at my McDonald's, and then I upgraded to All Bar One, £3.65 an hour, showing you how old I am. So I took out my student loans, which had just been introduced at university, and I started trading them on the stock market. I got my first job in an investment bank in my first year summer holiday after my career service told me I was never going to be able to get an internship in the city because I was going to final year students who were doing economics. I was doing French, Spanish and Italian, which apparently was pointless if you wanted to be in the city. So I went and got 2. Totally get that. So kind of fast forward to kind of the last, to my professional career. I mean, I worked in a bank for the first 7 years of my life. I IPO'd my first company at 29, which was actually real estate services and real estate. My second company was car parking, so we serviced real estate. My current business is a software company. Our software powers the corporate alumni networks of very large companies. I have always been very competitive. I like being first, and I have always been ambitious and driven, and I can honestly say that my ambition is, which is sometimes very un-British, and it's quite nice being in software in Silicon Valley because I'm just like not the weirdo. My aspirations for my business are substantial. I'm completely unapologetic about it. I spent, you know, the early years of my life being terrified to speak in public. I mean, can't shut me up now, but being terrified of speaking in public. So many things I found uncomfortable, and I think in the last couple of years, as often you do as you grow up, wherever you are, you feel a bit more comfortable with what you do, or I do, and that's certainly shooting for the stars. But probably like everybody else, I've had people that have been extremely important and have made it possible for me to feel that comfort. You know, and there have been so many downs as well as ups, which are sort of very typical in all our careers. And I think possibly if you're a founder, those are kind of slightly more extreme because you know, it's probably arguably a different, not less, but very different cushion perhaps in your business as you're growing. You know, my last business, I had several hundred people working for me. It's a responsibility if you can't pay people's payrolls, all the other things that you will have in different sort of scales and sort of levels of ownership. So, yeah, that's my very short story of how I got to where I am now.
With everyone's stories told, we turn to what mentoring really means. Emma kicks us off with the importance of having and identifying your tribe. And of course, that story about that spider.
I'm quite Marmite, so I say things that can be a bit divisive. So I absolutely hate the term mentor. Mm-hmm. I always think, you know, you just get something from everybody. So almost in every way, you kind of give and take from everybody. As it happens, you know, aside from family, you said that my father's been seminal. But one of the most important things probably for me latterly and in the times when I've most accelerated, and probably the same for everyone else here, is I think there's a huge value in tribes. So perhaps your tribe is your diving team, perhaps your tribe is your Estates Gazette, you know, team, perhaps it's the people you work with. You know, about 18 months, in the last sort of 18 to 24 months, I've done a lot more the political persuasion. Mm-hmm. I'm not particularly crazy about politics, but we all get lovely opportunities given what we do for a living. And you know, I fronted the Prime Minister's trade mission to India last year. I went with the Mayor of London to Chicago on a trade mission, and I went to Silicon Valley with 11 other female founders of super high growth tech companies. And I have a WhatsApp group, which is the 12 female founders from that group, and I think we're very lucky with chemistry. But that WhatsApp group is my lifeline. You know, do you have a legal document, do you understand, can anybody help with whatever it is? I'm having a bad hair day, my boyfriend dumped me, my pet died, whatever it is, from like kind of, you know, the does anybody know how to do something terribly complicated with convertible loan notes taking investment, down to the, you know, I need a heart emoji because I'm having a really hard day. So I think really different tribes that I've picked up along the way have been very important. The other thing in terms of mentorship in a slightly different way is actually what you could is how you know you get what you get from around you. I started meditating, which I think is definitely a great thing for me, and I haven't meditated for about 3 weeks, which is why I'm not breathing, speaking fast, ratty and tired. I've also been away for 48 hours in Venice, and I have come straight from a foreign trip to be here because Sam is the boss. When Sam says to be here, it's like
yes,
I am.
Even spiders had to be removed.
Yes, apologies for being late. It was because I had to pull over and wait 10 minutes until I could find someone that would remove a spider from my car. So
the WhatsApp group couldn't help you with that.
They couldn't, and I stood there, called my other half, and then waited for somebody to come past and said, "Would you get the spider?" But you know, I think actually, you know, people around me. But I've actually got a lot from being a bit quieter, meditating, and speaking to people completely unrelated and outside of my circles. So that's like for meditating, that would be a Vedic master. For I'm interested in, like everybody else, no doubt, nutrition or whatever else it is, and speaking to people completely unrelated to my world has definitely been interesting and important.
And here's Roz, providing more evidence that your mentors are not necessarily inside your business.
I've never had a mentor, but actually what I've realised probably in the last 10 years, that my mentors are my running group. And I have 5 friends who are ex-Goldman Sachs, ex-Barclays, all industry, teacher, and the nutter, ex-lister. but they are a group of people who in varying degrees of in business, and we go out and spend time together, and we are very, very good friends. And they've actually mentored me probably in the last 10 years through that period of going, you know, what do you think I should do? Where do I go? What do I didn't really want to do? and they have been that sounding board that has constantly gone, look, do it. You know you can do it. You know, and I'd actually, my husband doesn't do that for me. Because there's almost a sort of competition. He's in the real estate industry, and there's an element of but you know, there is that you can't get away from the fact when you're in the same industry and you're talking to people that you know you very, it becomes its own challenge. So, you know, you've just kind of distilled it for me in terms of actually what represents for me my mentor group, which is people completely outside of what I do, but they know me, they understand me, and I can tell them anything, and they'll give me what they really think.
Do you know that the running groups are supposedly corporately the most powerful group of people in any large enterprise, because it's probably the purportedly, according to like workforce studies, the most democratic group of people, because it's based on your running ability and not where you're in a company. So you tend to get really well-rounded advice because you get people that you might mix with outside of your everyday ecosystem. So
what I took from that is, if you're not in a running group, you should join one now. Not only do you get fit and get to buy cool Lycra and trainers, which is always a bonus for me, but you get access to some of the greatest and the widest spectrum of advice out there. Anyway, here's our collector, Linda.
I've collected people along the way, actually. The only job anybody's ever given me a mentor in was, you know, sort of 14 years into my BT career when I became property director. They went, right, now you need a mentor. And he was a lovely guy, actually, in fairness. I mean, I've got a guy who I wouldn't know called Clive Ansell, who was the group strategy director. He was key in securing the London 2012 Olympics. Yes. So BT, one of the teams, one of the businesses who actually put the money up to actually sort of try to bring the London 2012 Olympics into the UK. So he was absolutely fantastic, because I think he did a lot of the things that you were describing, you know, stuff with me, who, yeah, and I knew I'd been in the company for a long time, as had he. And it was the questioning and the challenging, because the one thing I hate about being a mentor is when people come and approach you, particularly as a senior woman in any industry, and I've had this in every business I've ever worked in, thinking you are going to pull them up that ladder. So actually, you know, with Clive, I was never put in that position. I was just being told, right, you've got this job now, you need a mentor, which I thought, crikey, I've been in the company for 14 years. You've trained the hell out of me, now you can be a mentor. But like I say, I did learn quite a lot, and I didn't behave like that. But the minute I went into that property director's job, what was really interesting was I had a load of people come and approach me and say, actually, will you be my mentor? And I always say yes. I always do the cup of coffee and the sort of chat, and I know probably within about 5 seconds whether or not it's actually going to work. And it's not because I'm highly judgmental, critical nut job. It's because actually what normally comes out of that person's mouth is, I've been in the business for 5 years and I can't get promoted. And then when you ask them the question as to why they think that is, and, you know, sort of what they're doing, you know, who they work with, you know, how are they working, you realise very quickly that anybody that actually is coming thinking your mentor can fix that, it's the wrong conversation. Mm-hmm. That's a line manager conversation. So having got my mentor, who is the only one I've ever had, I then proceeded to probably collect a number of people over the years who were people I worked alongside, who were people I'd worked for, who people who'd actually ended up working for me, people I had met in transactions where I spent 15 months locked in a room till all hours of the day trying to sort of get transactions over the line, and you just click with them. What I would say is I've got probably a group of about 10 people of all ages, from all sorts of backgrounds, mainly real estate sector in fairness, who are my sounding boards, and they are the people who tell me how it is. They are the people who will say to me, this job's not doing you any good. And actually, sometimes in banking, actually, the point I went in where they hired me and said, it's over, we're through it, don't worry about it, 2010, and it became even worse for about 2 years. You know, actually, those are the people who said, you know, actually, you've changed, you know, this isn't good, you know, this job is actually harming you. Mm-hmm. And I realised, actually, after about 9 months it was, and I had to make the adjustment and actually change the way that I thought about myself and actually how I was doing that job, and realise that there were, regardless of how hard I tried, there were some things I was not going to be able to do anything about. And, you know, I would say it was that group, the people who had been my referees, my sponsors, who basically sort of kept pulling me back to planet Earth. And, you know, I did not enjoy it. I hated the first 7 or 8 months because I just thought, God, what have I done? Like, why have I done this? but actually after that it was okay. And I think, you know, collect people as you go through that you gel with, that are honest, and, you know, never let, what I would say is also don't let them down. So the reason I think I've still got this group of people with me after all these years is because I built the trust and I never let them down, because often if somebody chooses to step in and mentor or sponsor you, you know, what you do is a reflection on them, mm-hmm. you know, and if you basically, you know, whilst if you crash and burn, they'll pick you up. If you underperform, lie and sell a myth, that's not great for them. So you've got to, it is very much a two-way symbiotic sort of relationship that you need to get into.
Some really interesting points there coming from Linda, especially her driving home that idea that the mentoring relationship is a two-way thing, that mentor isn't there just to fix it for you, they're there to help you fix it, and also that what you do as a mentee reflects not only on you but on them. So how do we get the best from a mentor and be the best for a mentor? For Madeline, it's about picking that person you really want to be and not being afraid to learn from mistakes, either ours or our mentors.
I was sort of late one night, it was 8 o'clock, I was having a really bad day, and a guy I was working with just went, well, who do you want to be, what do you want to be, what's your aim? Like, and I was like, I've never even thought of, you know, where I want to be in 5-10 years. And he goes, okay, not where you want to be, who do you want to be? And I sort of just went, oh, I want to be that person over there. Who was heading up the capital markets team at the bank. He was an absolutely amazing lady. And he goes, well, just go and talk to her. Just go and say, you know, hear her story, hear what she's up to, and you'll find some people. And I've done that everywhere. I just now go, I want to be you. And so I go and talk.
Do you which when you meet someone who's amazing, I'm like, I love you, yeah. Which is a bit weird. I like, practically tell people I love them if they're amazing immediately.
Yeah, so I just target them, and there's some people who really respond to that, and they're like, great, and some people are like, I don't know who you are, you're a little bit weird, leave me alone. That's not my work model. But actually what I've found over the years as well is, I learned just as much from people who get it wrong as the people who get it right. So it doesn't have to be people who go, God, they're so brilliant, they get it right all the time, blah, blah, blah. We're all human. In fact, like, the more senior up you go, the more you actually find that they want your help as well, because they're more and more removed from the business and the people when they get more and more senior. And they make mistakes as well. And actually, when you find the mistakes they've made, the mistakes you're making, you learn more. It's that classic mistake, which is if you're doing everything right, you're not actually learning that much. You actually have to fail to get things right.
Or you're lying.
Yeah, or you're lying. Yeah. So it's you either have that very close relationship and they tell you where they've gone wrong and you tell them where they've gone wrong. Or you have people who are very arrogant, if we want, you know, to use that word, who don't believe they've got something wrong. You go, God, well, I wouldn't do it that way. And actually you can learn from those people just as much as you can from the people who help you.
Being able to learn from mistakes is one pretty good piece of advice that our panel had to offer. But what else have they taken on board for themselves? And what can we, the listener, and all of the Rewire tribe, as we are a tribe now, what can we take away with us? Madeline, like many of us, turns to her mum.
I need to learn to fail more and accept that failure is okay. And mum's always been like that. She's like, just put everything into perspective. So, you know, silly things like, start this year, I tried to have my wisdom teeth out and it all went horribly wrong and I ended up with, looked like elephantitis, and I was going to work and I could barely speak, and mum's view was, well, you've got 31 other teeth, darling, or 32 other teeth, it's fine. And like, that has been just consistent in my life, and it's just like, I think we get so bogged down in the day-to-day of everything, we forget to lift our head up and go, it's really that big a deal. It's like your point, if you're really unhappy, I think we get trapped in our jobs or what we're doing and we can't see the broader picture. It's about lifting your head up and just putting everything into perspective.
My general motto is, unless someone's died, everything's fine.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the same ilk, because otherwise I would just be wild with stress.
If any of the audience haven't seen it, the TED lecture, Teaching Girls to Be Brave, Not Perfect, you have to see it. Because if that isn't the strongest message I've heard, and I get all the guys in my team who've got little girls, I think you get on that. Because it's a woman's thing. We don't take ourselves out of comfort zones. Mm. We don't do it naturally. boys do it naturally, and that's because of where we've come from in terms of the nature of the upbringing. I don't think it will apply to the young women going forward.
Do you
not? Different breed.
No, it's such an interesting conversation, because 20 years ago, my scariest first moment, and this woman saying to me, "Was things haven't changed." And I'm like, "Well, you know, I've just worked at a company, I do this, I do that, full of beans." And she was just like, you know, I used to think that 20 years ago, and I was like, oh my God, she's just like so grouchy, everything's fine, women are changing it, we're trailblazing. And I have to say, I mean, I know I'm just becoming even more hardcore as life goes on, but half the time now I'm just constantly reading shit that's just completely unacceptable. I want my legal documents to say she, but there's just so many things that are just are not changing in a way that I predict. You know, for technology, the percentage of women in technology is going down. So, I mean, I also totally
agree.
No,
I think technology has a massive challenge in terms of again, it's the stereotyping of what girls can and can't do. I think there
real
is.
Real estate has that too.
Yeah,
and
then pretty much
it
everything
does.
Has
but yeah. I think the attitudes of parents now with small children who are girls, you are moving away. You know, we've got John Lewis
genderless
now.
Genderless clothing. Yeah.
Genderless clothing. And you know, you have a mentality that is coming in that is saying, and the guys will say it, they want their girls to have the same attitude and opportunity and approach to life. And there's an element of how we're wired. I do think there's an element of how we're wired. But it is about challenging yourself. And it's harder when you're grown up. But I think there will be a sea change, because the conversation now is everywhere.
You say that, so I totally agree. Conversations everywhere. There's like, I didn't have any diversity groups when I was starting in investment banking. There were no women's sections in newspapers. There wasn't this kind of stuff. You know, you were on your own sort of thing. But I mean, you know, statistically, if you look at women on boards, women, if you look at every,
no,
I'm not,
but you
I'm
can't
not
change.
Missed.
You can't change it. You can't move. It's a generational
100%.
Move.
I believe the thing that I think is going to shift the needle is going to be women exiting very large businesses, because women currently don't really invest. Women currently don't typically back women. It's not they back men, they just don't back. So I think there's quite a lot of things that need to happen in this generation. For example,
it's not perfect, though,
no,
is it?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, so without wanting to be a bloke, given sort of what's in the and actually, the best piece of advice I was ever given.
No offense, Leon.
The best piece of advice I was ever given, and I think it goes to the point that you just made about how women behave, was about 1995, I was sitting as one of our main board members, so it was actually from York, was actually at the AGM, and I was sitting in the audience, and because he was well loved, he'd been in the business all his career, some of the audience were allowed to ask questions about, you know, sort of advice, and this guy had come from Apprentice and ended up on the main board of BT. It wasn't Cyrian Vance, but he was one of his contemporaries, because the guy had become chairman had also sort of done the similar route. And what he said, a guy called Mike Armitage, and he basically said, you know, every now and again in my career a door opened, and he said, and I'd go through the door, and sometimes, like, you know, there'd be sort of stairs up and it'd sort of all work and it'd be great. Every now and again there was a bloody great big chasm on the other side, and I'd fall through it, like, not wondering where I was going to land. He said, but always, it was okay in the end. And the one thing that stuck with me, and one piece of advice I'd give to you, is go through the door. Because actually, you've got to be brave. Because I think, you know, I think what you were saying earlier, you know, was actually the point you were making is we're not naturally built like that. You know, we have different expectations. I don't think we have at all.
I agree.
I was told that, to me, the best piece of advice, the thing that resonated with me all my career, was go through the bloody door. If you stand on this side of the door, and you look back in 20 years and you think, oh, I wish I'd done that. I mean, what good's that? You know, you've got a life that's going to be 80-odd years. We're women, we live longer than men. You know, actually, we've got a bloody long time on the planet. So if the door's there, go and have a look what's on the inside. Because to be honest, if nobody dies, you know, and actually even if you skid on, you know, down and sort of across the bottom a bit, you come up the other side, but saying, I wish I had, or I could have. Yeah, that's not a way to live your life. You know, so what I would say is, you're young, you're starting your careers, go through the bloody door, because there is not a lot that can go wrong, actually, that you can't change. And it's the advice I give to my kids, actually.
And definitely
boys
not low-key advice, as far as I'm concerned, at all.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just life advice, right? That's just that's just taking an opportunity.
But
like,
it's more
male. With it.
I think, actually, when I went back to the early parts of my career, that was more a male, you know, the guy would have no reason, he'd have no inhibitions about going through the door. Often women would be thinking, overanalyzing it. Actually, you know, it's exciting, go through the door.
Because we think about 10 million different
They just go, do it, and we'll deal with it when we get to it. And they're going, but what happens
if... And if you can't do it, just, you know, you just pretend you can, which is basically certainly what I've been doing for an extraordinarily long time.
And
people believe it.
If you look back and think in 20 years' time, you haven't done half the things you've done, they go, I wish I'd done
it. That would be my regret, your point.
But with respect, we represent, you know, four independent, strong-minded women.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of women out there who, you know, I walk.
You weren't always, so for example.
No, I was always. I've always walked into the room thinking these people are happy to have me in this room. Not I walked into the room thinking they're not right. So, you know, I understand that about myself. So in some ways, it's been very easy for me because my life has been rotating around thinking people want to spend time with me.
And they might not.
You have a massive cohort of women who have to overcome. They are very, very able, can do everything that whatever we've done, but they do have barriers to overcome. And I think I'm so delighted that this is the theme, mentoring, because I think with mentoring, a lot of women can overcome challenges. Just because it's just about being brave and what's the worst that can happen. And don't overanalyze it. Just get on and do it and work out what it is. Because the only person who's going to be critical about you is yourself. And if you can get over that issue of being critical about yourself and going, you know what, nobody died. What's the worst thing that can happen?
Most people don't care as much as you think they do as well. I mean, the other thing is, like, you know, you're not the centre of the known universe. If you're a bit nervous or worried about what everyone thinks, quite frankly, quite possibly, a lot of people don't give a shit. So just get on with it.
That's one of the best pieces of advice someone's given me. They're like, if you're nervous, just make out you know what you're talking about. No one really listens.
No one really listens.
So I tried it out and I said something that was completely outrageous and no one was listening.
Maybe it's just that you said it with such authority and they were like, oh, pigs can fly.
Yeah.
I totally believe you.
My husband says that to me all the time. He goes, oh my God, it's taken me 10 years to work out. You just say things, but you have no idea. And then I find out 2 weeks later, you have no idea. I'm like, yeah, I know.
If you put four confident women on a panel, you're sure to come up with some good advice. From don't sweat the small stuff, to open every door, to fake it till you make it. Unfortunately for you, listener, the tables got turned on me to proffer up something that I might have learned from, let's call it, the extracurricular activities I might do outside the office.
So you do all these crazy things, running up mountains and, I don't know, jumping in cold water that just wouldn't jump in a wetsuit if it was me. So what's been, you know, your greatest piece of advice? Because presumably you must have had a lot of pain, injuries, bad days, very cold.
Yeah, you're just describing a week at EG. I think it's, you know, however bad it gets, it always gets better. And I think for me, the darkest moments I've been in is when I've got to a point where I can't go on and I always think I can do everything. And in the end, I started looking for the thing that I couldn't do because I needed to find a barrier so then I would have a new goal to come over it. So I think that's the greatest lesson I've learned for myself and how I guess I sort of mentor myself that if I want to be a rock star, it's like, well, of course I can do it, and if I don't do it this time, then there'll be another time that I might do it.
So for me, like much of the theme that we've already heard throughout this podcast, it's about learning from failure and not being afraid of failure, and actually sometimes setting yourself up for something that others might think you'll fail at. To just go for it, just ask for it. That is exactly what the panel's attitude was.
I've never asked. I've just done it. You know, and I think, never ever asked.
Well, I think, look, nowadays you have regular catches up with your line manager, you have regular one-to-ones, and you know, you have to use those forums to raise your expectations and say, this is what I'm expecting. So I would say, like, if you don't ask, you don't get. But it doesn't have to be aggressively done. It can just be, you know, having those regular dialogues saying, these are my expectations. Please tell me if you think these are way off whack or what I need to do. You know, I will have to do them. It's not about, you know, you doing that job for me, but what do you think I need to do in addition to these, or how can you help me to meet that standard so I can progress?
I think it's very British not to ask.
Yeah.
The older I get, the better I get at asking. Certainly for myself, you know, until recently, in terms of, you know, it's taken me a long time to to feel unapologetic. And I just think that that is something that we should, could, and must learn from US style, frankly. In terms of when I was in a business, you know, I didn't ask as much, but I was first in, last out, worked really hard, and you know, and got ahead in that sense. But these days, you know, I ask more, and I wish I had asked more when I was younger, because it would have catalyzed things even further. And you know, it's just like, what are we waiting for? Just ask.
I think the other thing is if you're asking and you're getting constant no's, back yourself.
Just move.
Back yourself so you can start another career somewhere else. If you have that blocker there, I mean, obviously try and work it out in different ways first. Don't just immediately resign. but you know, you've got to back yourself. I've been in, you know, I think we all, well, sorry, apart from Roz, we, you know, moved several times, and you know, I've been in 4 or 5 different places. And you've just got to have that confidence in yourself to do that.
Yeah, I think that's the qualifying point I have never asked, because actually if I've not got what I want, I'll just move.
Yeah.
You know, so
just taking it.
Yeah, because I do think that is something that comes with age, experience and confidence, is actually it is the backing yourself. It's if you're never gonna get, you know, what do I need to do to get on the board? Well, they told me something that, you know, I was thinking, I've been here for 14 years, I said earlier, 5 more years doing that, like, why do I want to do that? And I just moved. You know, There is life outside, you know, sort of wherever you are at the moment, actually, and, you know, find something you want to do.
We've heard that message before at Rewire. Both Baroness Ford and Granger's Helen Gordon said that if you're not being appreciated for what you're worth, do not be afraid to move. It's clearly sage advice. Which brings us to a conclusion. How do you find and build the confidence to do all of this? The answer comes, clearly, from the woman who told us girls run the world.
My answer is Beyonce. seriously, yeah, for real. I was mortally shy as a child, and through my early 20s, I was always often a leader, but I found it very, very traumatic and sort of very terrifying. And I read this article in Vanity Fair in The Hairdresser, and it was Beyonce, and she was saying that when she goes on stage, she has an alter ego, and that's Sasha Fierce, and that's, you know, she thinks about it, she projects that she's like a rock star. And I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, fuck, she needs an alter ego. And I went to my first ever event where, as a listed company, we're getting an award. I mean, I was 29, a listed company, I walked into a room of 900 people in the Grosvenor House, and I remember I could see, you know, zero women. And I went back upstairs, called my boyfriend at the time, and was like, I can't do this, I can't stand it on my own. Someone had asked me on the stairs downstairs whether I was doing the event PR. I just couldn't handle anything. I was like completely overwhelmed. And he was like, Sasha Fierce. And you know, for some time afterwards, amongst other things, whatever it was I needed to do to get things done, I used to just think to myself, right, Sasha Fierce. So I recommend Beyonce, just put some Beyonce on.
Yeah, Taylor Swift, Shake It Off.
Yeah, or Confidence, by, which is also my other track I put on when I'm sometimes been in. What's it, by Demi Lovato, I totally recommend Crack Pop. Sage advice from my years of wisdom.
My story will demonstrate to you that it didn't come from my mother. I was down in the West Country, if I come from Bristol, and it was only about 4 or 5 years ago, and I was going to an event at Burgess Salmon, who were a firm of lawyers, for an evening event, and I dropped in to see my mother in the afternoon. She's 92 now. And I said, I can't stay later, Mum. I've got to go to an evening event at Burgess Salmon. And she looked at me and she said, Burgess Salmon? She said, they're a very important law firm, you know, Roddy. I said, yes, I know. Yes, I'm going there tonight. And she said, are you serving the canapes? and I was 45 years old by this point. So clearly it didn't come from my mother. But I had the advantage of 3 older brothers, so I was almost brought up as a boy. As they brought a little test in the office, they'd never see me in a dress. Do you know what the secret for me is? Talk to people, because people love talking about themselves, and the more they talk, the more you get to know what they are and what they're about and how they operate. And I think when you go into a room and it's that smile and happy and engagement, people, if people like you and you start and talking and you indulge them, because people love to talk about themselves, you get to know them. And you make your whole situation in a work situation so much easier, because you get a handle on that individual and you get to think, okay, well, how do they operate? How do I work with them to get the best out of this relationship? It sounds very commercial. It is commercial, but you're doing things that are very easy, that if they don't come easy, practice it and do it, because walking into a room with people that you're not going to know many people, it is an incredibly engaging thing to go over to somebody in the corner of the room who you know you're not going to know. They're there going, I don't know anyone here either. You go over and talk, doesn't matter what you talk about. You can get onto the work bit, but you just engage, and you very quickly build up very positive opportunities, in my experience, and you just start gathering more and more people around you who become fans, if you like, because they think, yeah, good person, wants to talk to me, wants to understand me. You know, you'll end up never actually talking to you about yourself. That doesn't matter, it's work.
Yeah, I'm an eldest child, so with siblings that are sort of quite space, so I think apart, so that's not space, but I'm not sure the word that's really. So I think I actually grew up quite quickly because of the, you know, when I was 3 and a half when my sister was born, and then I must have been 7 when my brother was born, and it just meant that my mother had like less time for me. So, and I was really independent and quite feisty. As I said, I mean, I was always in trouble and I was always fighting, which wasn't great because I was normally fighting boys. So I think some of it is in you. But I think my dad, you know, sort of was probably a big influence for me because I was first, he had 2 girls and then a boy, and he really sort of wanted the boy. We sort of knew that. He loved his girls. But he used to say there's no such thing as calm. You know, I grew up in a traditional Yorkshire mining village. It was quite male sort of, and quite, you know, sort of society. And my dad was just like, you know, always, there's no such thing as calm. You get out and do it, you know, you don't stop. And I think for me, I never wanted to let him down. And so I just kept going. And what I found in work, because I remember going into, like, when we went back up to Leeds in 93, I went into this massive office, 200 people, and I was as senior as all the other male managers, and I'd come up from London, and although I'm a Yorkshire girl. And they were about as frosty as you could get. There was 4 or 5 of them, and there was me, and there was the guy who was the sort of boss in our sort of region in BT. And then there were sort of 3 or 4 head guys, and they all had officers, and they made me sit outside with the team on the floor of 200, which I didn't mind, because actually I knew more about how that business worked by the end of about month 3 than these guys in their offices ever knew. Bizarrely, they all ended up working for me within about sort of 18 months, but that was a different story. But the funny thing about, but you know, that was how I was treated, and I just got on, I just networked with the people, I found out how it worked, I looked at the problems, I broke them down one bit at a time. And when people didn't listen to me because I was very young, and most of these guys were at least twice my age and didn't want to give their offices up, I used to just prove, you sometimes have to just prove people wrong, mm-hmm. but again in a nice way, so you have to do the work, be really sure of your facts, present them an unassailable position, mm-hmm. and eventually they get with the programme. But it is quite hard, and it's quite lonely actually. I mean, the one thing I would actually say, that there are points like that, even in somebody who's noisy, loud and confident, you know, There are very lonely times when you're sort of trying to establish yourself into a business like that, but you just have to keep going and never turn the opportunity down to sit in the main office, because people tell you everything. It's absolutely brilliant.
I'll just do a quick one. Confidence is all about being prepared.
Yeah.
Everyone feels nervous if you're going in and go, I have no idea what I'm... So, you know, I spoke in an event the other day, and someone was like, oh my God, I could never do what you did. You just spoke for like 15 minutes and, you know, like, it was brilliant. And I was like, oh, I've been practicing for like 2 days. And they thought I'd just gone in and gone, oh yeah, it's not a lot. And actually, it's amazing. Being prepared, at least you'll still feel nervous or you'll still question yourself. But if you know that, like Leon says, like you did what, 20 years of work before you did that, nailed that dive, right? So if you can do that and take out some of the risk in terms of that side of things, then it helps.
For me, it's just wear ridiculous coloured trousers.
It's always nice to end on some laughter about something you've just said, isn't it? So in the words of my colleague and co-host on EG's regular Tech Talk podcast, you can download that on a Tuesday if you're interested in tech. Anyway, in the words of Miss Emily Wright, so there you go. That was the latest Rewire event, kindly hosted by GVA and featuring the most wonderful panel of women, Linda Shillaw, Madeleine McDougall, Emma Sinclair and GVA's own Roz Good. And for those of you that made it to the event, the wonderful Leon Taylor, Olympic silver medalist, inventor of the world's most difficult dive, mentor to Tom Daley, and one of very few men we've actually ever let into a Rewire event. Thank you to everyone who was there. If you didn't make it and you'd like to attend future Rewire events, just email me, samanthamcclary@egi.co.uk, to join our tribe, or look me in the Rewire group up on LinkedIn. Our next event is at MIPIM UK on 18th of October, where we'll be giving people the chance to ask the questions that they might be a little bit afraid to ask about diversity, gender bias, whether that's positive or negative, political correctness, workplace needs, etc. You can ask all of that to our expert panel. And if you don't want to do it publicly or you can't be there, there'll be an opportunity to ask anonymously. You can just email me and I'll do the asking for you. But in the meantime, stay fierce.